is CBS Eye on the World. Here's John Batchelor.
The light of battle, Eisenhower D-Day and the birth of the American superpower. I welcome and congratulate the author, Michel Paradis, because this takes us to a part of the 20th century that we're still living. The ability of the U.S. to combine with the British Empire and the Soviet Union to defeat the Hitlerites and remake the map of Europe one more time. We go to this story, however, not in Europe, but in Washington, D.C. It is January 1944. A man named Eisenhower is present at the table at the Alibi Club, 1806 Street, Northwest Washington. A very exclusive club, only 50 members at one time. George Marshall is a member. George Marshall has ordered, requested, urged, suggested that Dwight Eisenhower, a general who has been successful in North Africa, but a man who also thought he was going to be sidelined for the big show, the Second Front, he has ordered Eisenhower to come home for rest for 10 days and also to meet the politicos of Washington, because Eisenhower is going to carry the burden of the rest of the war in Europe, and that requires money and attention and political success. Michel, a very good evening to you. Congratulations. Why is George Marshall requesting Eisenhower? What can Eisenhower do for him? What can he do for Eisenhower at this moment? Good evening to you.
Good evening. A real pleasure to be on, and very much looking forward to talking about it. Yeah, George Marshall is, you know, obviously one of the lions of the 20th century. You know, some would say that he was even more powerful, certainly in matters of war and peace, than even FDR. There was a joke, and it was only kind of a joke, that when Marshall would go to Capitol Hill asking for funding for a new military program, they would ask if this was what he wanted or is it what Roosevelt wanted. And if he said it was what Roosevelt wanted, he could kill an entire initiative just with those few words. So, you know, George Marshall is the center of the, you know, at that point, global war in the Pacific, in Europe, and, you know, fighting at a scale and with a sophistication and a complexity that no one could have even imagined 2 years before that. And it's difficult to even get your head around today. And he knows, after Eisenhower is selected by Roosevelt to be the Supreme Allied Commander, that the job ahead for Eisenhower is a military position, to be sure, but it's just as much a political position, that getting the, you know, American and Allied forces onto the beaches of Normandy and then into Europe is going to turn far more on the appropriations they get from Congress, on the Navy's willingness to provide landing craft, on Eisenhower's political support and credibility, than it will ever turn on Eisenhower's brilliance, you know, as a battlefield commander. And it's important in January of 44, because though Dwight Eisenhower, you know, himself becomes one of the, you know, major figures of not just the war, but of the 20th century, in January 1944, he's only one of many generals who had, you know, who would probably today, had he not been chosen to lead Operation Overlord, would be remembered like Wayne Clark or George Kenney or all sorts of other generals that historians of World War II obviously know and know a lot about, but who are not, you know, the household names, whose faces literally are not on money. Marshall knows that he needs to elevate Eisenhower's profile from being just the genial commander who, you know, managed Allied operations in the Mediterranean to really being the kind of, you know, major figure, the world leader with stature that Eisenhower has yet to become. And this meeting, this in a literally a smoke-filled back room in an exclusive club in Washington, is where Marshall really introduces Eisenhower as, you know, a more significant figure, as not just another general.
One of the politicos that night is Bernard Baruch. What does Eisenhower think of Bernard Baruch? What does Baruch make of Ike?
There's a lot of admiration, especially from Eisenhower to Baruch. You know, one of Eisenhower's, you know, introductions to Washington and the world of military politics is in the early 1930s, when there's a a congressional initiative to do a deep study into war profiteering, based on, you know, concerns that, you know, war profiteering, what we might even now today call the military industrial complex, can lead the United States astray. And Eisenhower is one of the key staffers in conducting this study from within the War Department, and kind of becomes disillusioned quite quickly with Washington politics, as one person after another, you know, often eloquently, if there's someone like Filarello LaGuardia, you know, comes before this committee and just waxes about things they know nothing about, in Eisenhower's term, right? They're idealists. And it's not that Eisenhower is hostile to idealism, but he's fundamentally a pragmatist at heart. And he gets very exhausted by people, you know, proposing that the United States should embrace socialism, that, you know, whatever your pet political project is the way that the United States should ensure its peace and security in the future. And the one breath of fresh air that Eisenhower sees in this, you know, in this sort of debate over America's, you know, position as a military power is Bernard Baruch, who is, you know, an incredibly wealthy, largely self-made financier, who testifies in front of the War Plans Committee, and just with specificity about how you stop war profiteering, how you make sure the economy can be mobilized, how you actually solve the problems that needed solving, as opposed to providing some grand theory of everything that he was there to sell for the newspaper men. Today we would say we're, you know, selling to the cameras or to Twitter. And so he sees Bernard Baruch at this early stage in his own career, with great admiration. And as you know, Bernard Baruch becomes one of, you know, the key advisors to FDR, particularly on economic and economic war policy. And so Eisenhower has, in a sense, is given at this moment at the Alibi Club, the opportunity to really sit around the table with someone who he had admired for a long time as the kind of just clear thinker, about the issues of the day that Eisenhower just admired and found so rare and modeled himself after in his own approach to the difficult problems he would confront as Allied commander, but then obviously ultimately as president as well.
The other relationship at that table that is critical to the story is that between Eisenhower and Marshall. Marshall is a man who kept everyone at arm's length, and Eisenhower continued to have doubts that Marshall trusted him. What do you make of their relationship, what they left behind to tell us, Michelle?
Yeah, it's one of the, you know, probably one of the most important mentor-mentee relationships, obviously of Eisenhower's life, but I would actually say of American history. Because I think if Eisenhower had one key to success in his own life, you know, how he goes from being, you know, a young man growing up in the middle of nowhere in Abilene, Kansas, to being one of the preeminent figures of the 20th century, it's one of his great skills was cultivating mentors. And he had a series of them, and many of them were quite difficult people, and many of them were quite different people. Before Marshall, Eisenhower's sort of principal mentor was Douglas MacArthur. And there was no one more different from George Marshall than Douglas MacArthur. And so when Eisenhower ultimately comes to work for George Marshall in December of 1941, really by accident, Eisenhower sees what Marshall needs, anticipates what Marshall wants, and most importantly, I think especially from Marshall's vantage point, is he does it without making demands as well. One of Eisenhower's, I think, great interpersonal and I would even say diplomatic and political skills was always making sure that it wasn't about him. It was about the objective. It was about what they were all trying to do together. And he was, you know, probably part of it does come from just being, you know, from Kansas. He's almost self-effacing to a fault. And Eisenhower, as a consequence, gains Marshall's trust as someone who, unlike a lot of the other generals, to, you know, see the great opportunities ahead of them in World War II, Eisenhower comes across as someone who is ruthlessly competent, but who is able to keep his ambitions in check. And that in turn gives him a reason to trust Eisenhower. And so over the course of the war, Marshall sees someone who he can rely upon to, you know, not try and make it about him, not and try and frustrate Marshall's own interests and objectives, but really to do, this is a concept that's quite common in the military, you know, to really prize followership, and to treat his role as the you know, ultimately as there to make sure that Marshall's ideas as the chief of staff are carried out to the best of their possibility, that is ultimately Eisenhower's role. And as a consequence, he gains Marshall's trust and Marshall gives him more and more responsibility as a result.
The book is The Light of Battle, Eisenhower, D-Day, and the Birth of the American Superpower. It is January 1944. FDR next. I'm John Batchelor.